vast and trunkless legs of stone, stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies with frown and wrinkled lips, and sneer cold command. And on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. The literary among you will recognize the lines of a famous sonnet by Percy Shelley, a poet with a streak of anarchistic indignation in him that seethes beneath the tragic pathos of the scene he's describing. It. Who was this Ozymandias, you say? I've never heard of him. But that's precisely Shelley's point. For all his former glory, for all his pretentious titles, for all his megalomaniac claims, nothing is left of Ozymandias but a pathetic, broken colossus in a remote desert that nobody ever visits. Nothing beside remains, he continues in the final line. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. The poet's unspoken verdict is clear. Thus may all the proud conquerors of the earth meet their end, he says. Sunk in the oblivion of an ignominious desolation, the silence of the desert, their only epic. Shelley would have liked Daniel chapter 5, for in many respects it conveyed in narrative form the same contempt for tyrants and the same judgment upon their arrogance as his poem. The difference is that where Ozymandias, so far as I'm aware, is a figure of Shelley's imagination, Belshazzar of Babylon is most definitely a figure of history. Those of you who have been following our series of studies will know that it's set in the time of the exile. Jerusalem has been conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, and most of its population deported to Babylon. Among them, an exceptionally talented young nobleman called Daniel. The early chapters of the book that bear his name tell how Daniel rose to high office in the service of the empire by virtue of his divine gift of wisdom and prophecy. His long relationship with Emperor Nebuchadnezzar culminated, as we saw last week, with Nebuchadnezzar's conversion, his public acknowledgement of the sovereign majesty of the God of the Jews. So we find him testifying in the last verse of chapter 4, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble." How much time was left to Nebuchadnezzar after the events of chapter 4, we don't know. But it's clear that chapter 5 of Daniel takes up the story again some years later. Archaeological studies have been able to illumine the intervening period a little. We know that following Nebuchadnezzar's death, the power of Babylon declined very rapidly. The throne changed hands several times in rapid succession, probably as a result of violent coups by rival members of his dynasty. Eventually, a noble called Nabonidus succeeded in establishing a measure of political stability. But not for long. Internal squabble still prevails within the city of Babylon, and in the provinces, vassal peoples took the opportunity to reassert their independence. One young prince, in the north particularly, displayed extraordinary military genius. Capturing the kingdom of the Medes, he quite clearly was intent on carving out a place for himself in history. His name was Cyrus, the Persian. To make matters worse, Nabonidus himself seems to have been a bit of a religious crank. He abandoned the worship of Marduk, which was the official religion of Babylon, and resurrected instead the ancient cult of the moon god, Zin. He seems to have spent much of the time he ought to have been using pacifying his empire in excavating buried shrines and reviving long-forgotten rituals. Some scholars believe that it was in pursuit of this strange religious antiquarianism that in the final years of his reign, he deserted his capital city, Babylon, and went to live instead in the Arabian desert. Others, rather more cynically, suggest that he had seen the threat which Cyrus posed on his empire and decided he'd be safer out of the fire environment. But whatever his motive, the fact is Nabonidus left the great metropolis of Babylon in the hands of his son, Belshazzar, by name. Now, some of you may raise an eyebrow at that. Surely you will say to yourself, the Bible passage we just read says that Belshazzar was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Is the Bible wrong then? Liberal commentators, never reluctant to seize any opportunity to express their lack of confidence in Bible history, are quick to insist that indeed the Bible is wrong. The author of Daniel, they say, was lamentably ill-informed about the last days of Babylon, and this is just one of many errors he's made. But I don't believe there's any need for such skepticism. For quite often in the Old Testament, the word son is used in the loose sense of heir or successor. Thus Elisha was called the son of Elijah, though he had no genetic relationship to him. And this is particularly true in royal dynasties. So to entitle Belshazzar the son of Nebuchadnezzar doesn't necessarily imply that he was even related to him biologically. Although some scholars believe he may indeed have been his grandson. There is some evidence that that may be so. Whatever may be the case in regard to Belshazzar's relationship to Nebuchadnezzar, the key point, as far as the story is concerned, is that when at last the forces of the new Medo-Persian Empire of Cyrus swept south towards Babylon, it was the unfortunate Belshazzar who found himself seated on Nebuchadnezzar's throne. The evidence seems to be that Babylon surrendered almost without a fight. Cyrus, with considerably more diplomatic skill than Nabonidus, identified himself with the worship of Marduk, and refraining from bloody reprisals was quickly hailed by the populace as a liberator. So poor Belshazzar, like Shelley's Ozymandias, faded into political oblivion, without even a broken statue to commemorate his time. Indeed, if it were not for this chapter in the book of Daniel, it's most unlikely any of us would ever have heard of Belshazzar. Yet clearly the Holy Spirit believes his story has something to teach us. And it's that story and that lesson that we're going to be looking at together this morning. The story falls into two parts. First, in verses 1 to 9 of chapter 5, we find Belshazzar portrayed as the man who tried to forget. And in consequence of his trying to forget, he became a desperately frightened man. Then in the longer part, verses 10 to 31, we find Belshazzar portrayed as the man who refused to learn, and in consequence of his refusal to learn, became a tragically condemned man. Let's look first at the man who tried to forget. Verses 1 and 2. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet to 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. It's clear from what we are told at the end of the chapter, in verse 30, that the armies of Cyrus were already closing in on Babylon at this time. So this huge banquet must have been a rather pathetic attempt on Belshazzar's part to brazen the situation out. Was he perhaps worried about a preemptive coup on the part of some of his nobles? Was his lavish hospitality designed to disarm any gathering hostility among them? Or was it a piece of thinly disguised escapism in the spirit of let's eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die? Certainly the narrator seems keen to draw our attention to the amount of alcohol that was flowing. Whilst he doesn't actually say that the king was intoxicated, there is a definite atmosphere of debauchery about the proceedings, an atmosphere enhanced for his contemporary readers by the observation that in scandalous breach of the normal protocol of the Babylonian court, Belshazzar had invited his royal harem to the party too. It was a case of wine, women, and no doubt song. A reckless orgy of self-indulgence designed to take everybody's mind off the imminent political emergency. It's not clear what it was put into Belshazzar's head, the idea of replacing his normal dinner service with the sacred vessels which had been confiscated from the Temple of Jerusalem. Some suggest it was a drunken whim, a sort of silly eccentricity which inebriated undergraduates have been known to engage in, especially after May balls. But I believe it was rather more calculated than that. Do you remember I said that Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, was a religious eccentric with a special penchant for reviving outmoded deities from Babylonia's polytheistic past? Well, it's very tempting, I think, to see Belshazzar's actions in verses 2 to 4 here against the background of that current imperial religious obsession. Did Belshazzar superstitiously attribute the failing fortunes of the Babylonian Empire to Nebuchadnezzar's failure to venerate the ancient gods, I wonder? Was this great banquet in fact a religious feast, a bacchanalian festival designed to propitiate those ancestral divinities which Babylon had for too long neglected. If so, it could well be that the defilement of the temple vessels from Jerusalem was just one more public repudiation of Nebuchadnezzar's policy in this matter, and especially his known sympathy for the cult of Jehovah practiced by the Jews. There can be little doubt, I think, that that's how the author of Daniel interpreted it, for the opening paragraph of chapter 5 stands in stark contrast to the closing paragraph of chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar, in humility, is found confessing the supremacy of the God of the Jews, Belshazzar, in the very next paragraph, in his arrogance, is found confessing he's under contempt for the God of the Jews. So they brought in the gold goblet that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. And as they drank them, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. No drunken whim, this, then, but a deliberate act of sacrilege, a desperate final attempt to invoke the power of pagan deities in defiance of the so-called God of Heaven. It's not an unfamiliar scenario even today, is it? I remember some years ago having to deal with the daughter of a Presbyterian minister. Some say she's had an excessively religious upbringing, which may well have been true, but if so, she'd certainly overreacted to it. Convinced that all the problems were the result of a Christian upbringing, she engaged in a program of wild parties and drug abuse and promiscuous sex a lot, as if the only way to liberate herself from the consequences of her repressive childhood was to spit in the eye of the god her parents worshipped. Rather in the same way as we find Belshazzar here, spitting in the eye of the god whom Nebuchadnezzar had honored. When I met her, her cathartic fling had come to a sudden stop. She was in Addenbrooke, suffering from an overdose, her mind a jumbled confusion of anxiety and guilt. Perhaps it's no coincidence that that's pretty much where Belshazzar's pagan revelry landed him up, didn't it? The man who was so keen to display his public contempt for God was, we are told, at a stroke, reduced to a blubbering heap of terror. Suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. The narrator's deliberately playing up the comic aspects of the scene here for the entertainment of his Jewish readers. There's a touch of farce in his graphic description of Belshazzar's nervous collapse, and a definite air of pantomime in the way that, yet again, as so often in these stories, the wise men of Babylon are wheeled in like the ubiquitous chorus of a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. The king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners, and no doubt their sisters and their cousins and their aunts, to be brought in, and said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Notice, incidentally, that little touch of authenticity. The third highest ruler. Because, of course, there was Nabonidus as well as Belshazzar on the throne. But all the king's wise men came in and could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. And his nobles were baffled. One commentator likes this bevy of academics to the seemingly inexhaustible company of analysts and experts whom TV newscasters seem to be able to summon almost instantaneously these days to comment on any current event, no matter how unexpected or bizarre. The analogy is quite a good one, I think, and renders their speechlessness on this occasion all the more startling. For, of course, when professional experts are stumped, they can usually at least manage to bluff their way out through waffle. But these royal advisers seem unable to offer any kind of response to the king's inquiry at all. And in fact, the narrator seems to imply that they couldn't even decipher the words which the king had seen, let alone interpret them. You notice that in verse 8. They couldn't read the writing or tell the king what it meant. Some have suggested this was because they were written in an unknown script, or that the letters were jumbled up in some cryptic fashion. For myself, I suspect those commentators are right who suggest a much simpler explanation was in fact the case. The wise men couldn't read this writing because they couldn't see it. If you look carefully at the text, there's nothing to indicate that this disembodied hand inscribing its ghostly graffiti was visible to anybody except the king himself. Indeed, if you notice, we're told in verse 9 that while The king was terrified. Everybody else was simply baffled. Now, if a real apparition had appeared and been seen by everybody, one would have thought everybody's knees would have been knocking together, not just the king. Now, I suspect this was a case like the famous fairy tale of the Emperor's New Clothes, where if the king says he's seen something, everybody nods enthusiastically and pretends to see it too, while privately they're whispering behind the back of their hand, well, it's all in his mind, of course. Perhaps he thought he saw something in the shadow cast by that lampstand where he pointed. Must be the stress of the Persian invasion. Do you think he's suffering from the DT? They do say he's been hitting the bottle rather hard lately. There seems to have been only one person in the palace who was not paralysed by a protocol in this way. Verse 10. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. O king, live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There has been a great deal of interest among commentators over precisely who this royal lady could have been. Although our translation renders the word queen, it seems clear from verse 2 that Belshazzar's wives were already present in the banqueting hall, whereas this noblewoman was not. What's more, her bold entry into the king's presence without invitation and with a bare minimum of conventional obsequiousness proves beyond question that she must have possessed enormous personal prestige and authority. Many scholars, therefore, surmise that the word in verse 10 should not be rendered queen at all, but rather, as our NIV margin indicates, queen mother, a figure who was known frequently to be accorded far more prestige in the ancient world than the king's escort. Indeed, putting all the evidence together, it's far from impossible that this formidable matron of Babylon, who took the initiative at the 11th hour in this way, was none other than the widow of Nebuchadnezzar himself. And that would certainly explain her familiarity with court affairs during the days when Nebuchadnezzar had been on the throne. And it would also explain the definite note of indignation and even of rebuke which he directs at Belshazzar for his disloyalty to the memory of his illustrious predecessor. Look at verse 11. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians in charge of astrologers and diviners. This man Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel. He'll tell you what the writing means. That's what Nebuchadnezzar did. So the queen mother, alone perhaps of all the noble and royal advisers in the hall, recognizes that what Belshazzar has seen is no trick of the light, nor any alcohol-induced hallucination. No, it was a vision, a divine vision, like those dreams that had troubled Nebuchadnezzar, and which had had such a powerful influence. There had only ever been one man in the kingdom who could interpret such visions, and mercifully, he was still alive. Old now, and no doubt discredited and pensioned off, for though he'd once been senior professor in the University of Babylon, his monotheistic nonconformity was not likely to be tolerated in the current mood of pagan renaissance which Belshazzar and his father had instigated. Nevertheless, the king's anxiety stated so desperate, he's willing to try anything or anybody. So we read in verse 13, Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I've heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they couldn't explain it. Now I've heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple, have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Strange, isn't it, how quickly Belshazzar's contempt for the God of the Jews has evaporated away. How can a man be blasphemously defiling God's temple one moment, and then showering extravagant honours on God's prophet, isn't it? But such is the fickleness of a great deal of irreligion. People toy with atheism, you know, confidently affirming that modern science makes it quite impossible for a 20th century person to believe in God. They can be very short with any vicar who refuses to give their unbelieving partner a Christian funeral. People play with mysticism, expressing frightfully sophisticated opinions about how cool all this New Age philosophy is. But they're keen enough enough to ask Christians for prayer when their children become psychiatrically disturbed as a result of their occult dabbing. Again and again I've heard my faith patronizingly dismissed as mere escapism. You know, the fact is, when there's real trouble on the door, it's the unbelievers who try to escape, just as Belshazzar did, trying to drown his fears in champagne, the man who tried to forget, and in consequence became a very frightened man. No, when there's real trouble on the door, it's the believer who has something to say, just as Daniel did. And that brings us to the second half of the story. The man who tried to forget becomes the man who never learned. Verse 17. Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gift for yourself and give your rewards to somebody else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men, and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all." Notice that line. "You have not humbled yourself, though you knew all." The man who never learned. Those of you who were here last week will remember, I'm sure, the incident to which Daniel is referring here in the life of Nebuchadnezzar. The emperor, inflated by his military successes and conceited about the prosperity and grandeur of the new city of Babylon, which he himself had built, found himself suddenly struck down by a devastating mental breakdown. His narcissistic pride was shattered under the humiliating assault of a schizoid delusion. He believed he turned into a wild animal and acted out his madness, living in the open and trying to emulate the diet of a herbivore. Yet in the midst of his insanity, as is so often the case with the mentally ill, God was still real to him, and when at last he was granted a remission from his psychosis, he published an encyclical testifying to the spiritual lesson he had learned as a result of his ordeal. The concluding words we've already made reference to this morning at the end of chapter 4. "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble." All this, says Daniel, you, Belshazzar, knew. It was common knowledge in the royal court. The documents are in the royal library. You knew what Nebuchadnezzar's experience had been. You knew he, an emperor with more political power in his little finger than you have in your entire body, had been humbled by the Most High God, and confessed his supreme sovereignty over all the empires of men. Yet you thought you knew better. Petty monarch though you are by comparison, you thought you could defy the God who humbled great Nebuchadnezzar and get away with it. You have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you've set yourself up against the Lord of Heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praise to the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood and stone, which cannot see, or hear, or understand. But you did not honour the God who holds in his hand your life and all your wealth. Once again, we see why Daniel is rightly numbered among the Old Testament prophets, like Isaiah before Ahaz, like Jeremiah before Jehoiakim. He fearlessly denounces the blasphemous presumption of his pretentious monarch. But there is a major difference. Isaiah and Jeremiah were rebuking kings of Israel, kings whose culture was saturated in centuries of biblical heritage, kings who had the law of Moses on their bookshelves. Daniel was rebuking a king of Babylon, a king whose culture was saturated in centuries of pagan superstition, a king with nothing on his bookshelf, except the testimony of one converted predecessor in office. Yet, insists Daniel, it should have been enough. You should have known better, Belshazzar, than to challenge the majesty of the Most High God with such a calculated act of sacrilege. God might have overlooked the sin of ignorance, but these defiled vessels scattered around your banqueting hall represent a flagrant and deliberate act of contempt. Like Pharaoh before Moses, Belshazzar had waved his fist at God. Who is the Lord that I should obey him? And like Pharaoh, he would pay the price for his obdurate arrogance. The man who tried to forget became a frightened man. The man who would not learn became a condemned man. Verse 25. This is the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, pastor. And this is what these words mean. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Scholars have puzzled over the words of the vision, but it now seems clear that each of these three words, mene, tekel, and pastor, was in fact the name of a small weight, such as might have been used in the marketplace. So the underlying thought is that of divine assessment in the balances of heavenly justice. But Daniel, in keeping with the proverbial style of a Middle Eastern sage, has in fact woven a pun around each of these three words to reinforce that theme. Mene, that weight means your numbers, Belshazzar. God has numbered your days and decided you've reached your credit limit. Tekel, that means weighed, Belshazzar. God has weighed your life and found it short on goodness. And passing, that means two things, Belshazzar. It means divided, and it means hurt. God has appointed your execution. Tonight he will remove both your kingdom and your head. Yet, it still seems that King Belshazzar wants to pretend that all is well. He forces honours upon the reluctant Daniel, who has just announced, like the ringing of a funeral knell, the fall of his empire. At Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Is he trying to convince the nobles present that the oracle Daniel has brought was in fact an encouraging one? That is a mere whispering in the dark. For the writing was on the wall, indelibly inscribed by the hand of God. The moving finger had written. And now Belshazzar knew what it meant. No 11th hour compliment paid to the preacher were going to cancel the funeral. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius, the Mede, took over the kingdom at the age of 60. The lesson Belshazzar should have learned and failed to learn, of course, is simple. We human beings are accountable to the God who made us, and by whose grace we enjoy whatever power and privilege is ours in the world. He doesn't tell us when we should be called to give that account to him, but every one of us, no matter how mighty, that day will come. The boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all the beauty, all the wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. Path of glory leads but to the grave. In his day, Nebuchadnezzar had learned that lesson. Belshazzar, however, did not. The question, therefore, to which we return this week at the end of our story is, have we? Have we learned the lesson? Some of us undoubtedly have. We are believers ourselves. Like Nebuchadnezzar, our pride has been humbled. We've bowed the knee to the God of heaven. For such as that is true of, the story of Belshazzar is recorded for our comfort and encouragement. The Jews who read this book in the years after the exile needed its reassurance, for they lived in a hostile world where titanic forces of pagan empire, one empire after another, dominated the political horizon. They needed to know that no matter how formidable the tyrant, God would always have the last word. The writing was on the wall, not just for Belshazzar, but for every heathen despot who thought he could trample over the sensitivities of the people of God with impunity. The same lesson is not without relevance to the church at the end of the 20th century, for we too, like the Jews in exile, are increasingly reduced to little more than a minority sect in a world where secularism is calling all the shots. Christianity is lampooned by TV comedians and marginalized in the corridors of political power. Like Daniel, many Christians feel isolated, a lone voice in the university department, on the factory floor, in the office, in the classroom, a lone voice even in the family. Be assured, the story tells us, for the writing is on the wall. God shall have the last word. Truth may be forever on the scaffold and wrong forever on the throne, yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his eyes. So don't be afraid, like Daniel, to tell the truth you know to those who, like Belshazzar, do not honour the sovereign God who holds in his hand their life and all their ways, even though they're unprepared to miss it. So that brings into the other purpose for which this story is undoubtedly recorded. Not simply to comfort the believer, but also to discomfort the unbeliever. Shall I tell you something about the book of Daniel that we haven't mentioned in the past? It's almost unique in the Old Testament, because whilst it begins in the original being written in Hebrew and ends in the original being written in Hebrew, all the stories that embrace chapters 2 to 6, which we've been looking at in recent weeks, were written in the original not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic. Scholars are puzzled by this strange bilingualism. Why on earth should the narrator begin in one language, move to another, and then change back to the original language again? Various explanations have been offered, often based on theories regarding the book's literary history, and there may be some truth in it. But I give it to you as my suggestion that the fundamental reason that we find parts of this book of Daniel written in this unexpected choice of language is because, contrary to the general assumption of many commentators, this book was not written only for the Jewish community. It was not just a piece of Jewish nationalist propaganda. This book originally was also published as an evangelistic tract. See, Aramaic was the lingua franca of the Persian Empire. The author of Daniel used Aramaic for the same reason the apostles in the New Testament used Greek, because they didn't want just Jews. He didn't want just Jews to read what he wrote. He wanted to convert the Gentiles. If you're a non-Christian this morning, I have to say, I believe it's the intention of the Holy Spirit in relating this story of Belshazzar to convert you. Well, you see, the writing is on the wall. The writing's on the wall for you, as for Belshazzar. God has numbered your day. You are weighed in the balance. Sound wrong. Your opportunity for self-rule is shortly to come to an end. It's only a matter of time before God, who holds your life in his hand, calls you to account. Could it be that, like Belshazzar, you're trying to forget the inexorable advance of that day? Drowning your fears in alcohol, even, like him? Running away in the frenetic pursuit of pleasure? Refusing to acknowledge that the very breath that you take is the gift of God. We don't own our lives. We have them on loan. Like the vessels of the temple, we hold our lives as a divine stewardship. Are we then to dedicate that vessel to the profane idols of self-indulgence? Now you see what an act of blasphemous sacrilege it is to defile our lives in such a way. Be sure of this, there will come a moment for you, as for Belshazzar, when in the midst of our escapist career we are brought up short. God uses many tactics to break through the wall of spiritual amnesia we erect around ourselves. But not one of us can succeed in evading him forever. The writing is on the wall, and one day we will see it. Let me lie down and tell you what it's saying. It's saying, learn the lesson Belshazzar refused to learn before it's too late. We can't plead ignorance any more than he can. All he had was the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. We have Bibles and books, preachers. preachers and teachers Christian testimony by the score. Learn the lesson that Belshazzar refused to learn, that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men, and that he holds your life in his hands. What if he should decide to weigh your life in the scales of his justice today? Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, with frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command. And on the pedestal these words appear: My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sand stretched far away. Shelley is right, is he not? The world is littered with the broken relics of once great empires. Great men who thought to master the world, reduced to the trunkless legs of stone. Genghis Khan, Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, Stalin, Mayo. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Despair, Ozymandias, we do not despair. We pity. Pity the desert which was your life and which now surrounds your memory. Did you not learn the lesson either? Your name is not King of Kings. That title belongs to another. And his memorial is not a broken statue, but an empty cross. He is found today, not mouldering to dust in some lost tomb, but risen and glorified in heaven above. And from his throne, this true King of Kings and Lord of Lords reaches down to you and me to offer us forgiveness and hope. Learn the lesson Belshazzar refused to learn, and learn it soon.